Let's begin. OpenAI for Language Learning explores artificial intelligence through informal conversations between two longtime colleagues in language education and digital technologies, Matt Schultz, professor of German and director of the Language and Applied Research Center at San Diego State University, and Phil Hubbard, senior lecturer emeritus at the Stanford University Language Center. Rather than offering hype or tutorials, these conversations, occasionally with guests, are based on learning, reflection, evidence, and lived experience, with no prior AI knowledge assumed. Language educators, learners, and enthusiasts are invited to an informed discussion where emerging technology meets human communication.
All right. Opening AI for Language Learning. Hi, my name is Matt Schultz, and I'm here with
Bill Hubbard. I'm Senior Lecturer Emeritus at the Stanford University Language Center, where I taught English as a second language to graduate students there in various departments for over 30 years. Since retiring in the 2020s, I focused my work on teacher education and especially professional development. And that's something that I think will come through here today.
Yeah, and I am a professor of German at San Diego State University. By trade, I'm actually a high school teacher of German and Russian. I've been researching AI and language learning for the last 30 years. It kind of dates me somewhat, but it's been a while. I started off with working on my PhD, doing what they call a research prototype of a grammar checker for students of German with the good old-fashioned AI. Recently, and that's far more important, Phil and I wrote a journal article together, which was the starting point of these conversations.
Yeah, the article was a position paper that we collaborated on. It's driven by our mutual concern for the multitude of English teachers and other language teachers out there who did their training before 2022. And now they're faced with dealing with this AI phenomenon. Whether they want to or not, their students are likely to be using it. And we decided to take advantage of this paper invitation to put together some advice based on our own readings and experience to help them out. The paper comes up with 10 areas that we determined were important for teachers to have some background in right now, and especially language teachers, because some of these areas like chatbots and machine translation are different in language teaching and learning than they are in other fields. We also provide 7 sort of emerging principles to help guide this process, led by the idea that this is something that should be done quite regularly, perhaps even on a daily basis.
And then talking about principles and being principled, we thought it would be a good idea to actually also do what we preach and not just kind of write the paper about it, because this generative artificial intelligence is something we all need to learn about. It's come almost like a kind of huge tidal wave in some way, and pretty much everyone, including experts, are struggling with one area or the other and need some catching up to do and need to do some learning. Phil and I have done this in relatively informal conversations, actually, after we submitted the paper. And that was how the idea was born. Oh, maybe we can share some of those conversations. And this is what we're trying out now. In these conversations, the kind of very vague plan at this stage is that we will go through this paper, that we'll pick individual concepts, things we've read, things we're thinking about, and give them a good read, basically, and a good discussion in many different ways. And we're hoping that this will be beneficial. We're calling the series of conversations Opening AI for Language Learning. or Weil or something. I'm not sure how I would pronounce that with my German accent. You can, of course, you, the audience, can, of course, be part of it. In for future conversations, you'll be able to listen live. That's what we're hoping, and that's what we're preparing. And we're very much hoping that you'll listen to one or the other recording of these conversations. Okay. And this...
Oh, go ahead.
This kind of brings us to our first conversation, right? And so, yes, we're both going ahead. We came up with the maybe catchy title, What the LLM? And that's there to get us started.
Okay, so let's get started. So, Matt, what does LLM stand for? And what does it do? What is it?
Well, we're both linguists, so I'd like to, I do this often with complex concepts. I start off with the words. So here we've got a compound noun, adjective in front of it, which means compound nouns, you kind of disentangle them from the end. You look at the model first because it's a head noun of the whole phrase in some way. So first question, when you want to know what a large language model is, LLM, large language model, you're looking at the model. So what's a model? I'm casting my mind back to my days in elementary school, and we would literally do this with Play-Doh and drinking straws that we had to bring in from home. And we would build a cube with the different edges or pyramid or something like that. Why did we do this? And why did we do this in kind of elementary math class? To do what one does with a model, namely to learn about the thing. It's easier to learn about a model than it is to learn about a real cube, because they are all too different and it's kind of difficult, not only for children to see what is actually there to learn, namely that all edges of a cube are of exactly the same length, if you did it right, basically, with your model. So here, of course, we're talking about the language model. So there's, we're not really dealing with language as such. We've got a model of language. And that's the interesting part, I believe, of these large language models. That model is mathematical. It's really numbers. Yes, we put in something as the user of a large language model-based chatbot or something like that. We provide a prompt, make it do something. We prompt it, literally. We provide textual input. That input gets transformed into a large set of numbers, arrays of numbers, and many of those arrays, basically. These arrays get processed through different equations time and time again through multiple, what they literally call hidden layers, because you don't see them. You only see the prompt that goes in and you see the textual output that comes out. Everything mathematical is kind of hidden in the box, basically, in the machine. But all of that, trust me, is mathematical. All of that is numbers. Now, we know the language is not really numbers, right? So kind of there's a, so the model also cuts out something. Last thing is the adjective large, which of course is interesting in a way also because it is ambiguous. Is the language large or is the model large? Or is the kind of language model large? Of course it is the language model that is large. So, and they are really large with billions of parameters and things like that. They're humongous, based on many, many texts scraped off the internet. But the other meaning kind of resonates as well. The languages are better, they better be large as well, because then the large language model works better. Because you scrape off these texts off the internet, and the more texts you have, the better the model is. So this works best for a language like English, because many, many texts on the internet are in English. And to go to the other end of the spectrum, I remember listening to a presentation about the languages in the Arctic, basically indigenous languages in the Arctic. There was a specialist computational linguist talking about those, and he actually did the calculation for one of them with a kind of minute number of speakers, and he basically said if they wanted to have enough texts for the creation of a large language model, it would take them 14,000 years to create those texts, wow. basically. So, you know, things take a while. Languages like English, Spanish, whatever, a couple of others have a clear advantage there in some way, and we'll probably come to those questions of equity in some way also at some stage.
Well, that's...
All right, enough of the lecture.
That's great. So we have this idea that it's all numbers and there's a lot going on there that language teachers don't really need to know about at the math level, although it's great if they would. I certainly don't. But what does all this mean then for a teacher or a learner who's trying to make use of this for, say, as a chat bot or as in machine translation? What does it tell us about the real value of this if it's all just math?
Right. Well, I'll start off with the math. Emily Bender, who you know, and her colleague Alex Hanna, they're trying to be polemic, I guess, and don't call it AI, the new version, one we are dealing with now, because it's also become a buzzword and buzzwords get hollowed out, right? They call it massy mass to make a little bit of fun of it.
Yeah,
because it's so many numbers in there. What does that mean for a language teacher? It means that you're in, first and foremost, you're interacting with a machine and not with a human. We are not used to interacting with machines, so we are transposing our experience with interaction with humans, we're transposing this onto a machine and trying to do the same thing. So we get this very plausible, very well-formed output from an AI, Gen AI chatbot. And it happens to me. I believe it happens to all of us. We read it, and it feels like there's really somebody almost human talking to us. We're having a genuine conversation, like the two of us are having a conversation now. And that is not the case because of the math in there. We're dealing with a machine that acts very differently. It's just triggered. It doesn't have any intention. The machine does not want to explain anything to us. The machine does not want to answer our questions. The machine does not want to translate something for us. It can't. It doesn't have those intentions, at least as yet, the way they're kind of still structured and done. We are putting all this in, and I think to remember that is one of the most important things for teachers, because a lot of other answers for questions people will have at a smaller scale with a particular text, with a particular activity and things like that, with a particular learning, many of them derive their answer from that mathy math, basically. Being aware of it, it's simply a question of awareness. Nothing wrong with using those tools, but better be aware it's a tool, it's a hammer, and not a human who's doing hammering. It's just a hammer.
Yeah, so on a more personal level, as you pointed out, part of what we're trying to do is follow our own advice. And so I've been trying to do a little bit of language learning using this, while at the same time going back and reading about large language models, even reading the first part of our chapter that you wrote. Might have read it two or three times.
I hope it wasn't a bad time and you fell asleep or something.
No, it was quite clear, and I recommend it to everyone.
Thank you.
But I've also supplemented it with some other ones in it. it often comes back to what's it like then from the learner's side to be doing this. And so I've been trying to learn French, learn a bit of French, because I have family that live in French-speaking Switzerland. And they're quite good in English, but I'd like to feel comfortable in the area when I visit them. So I've been using Google Translate in practice mode to do this and noticing a number of things. We'll go into that probably in a later episode in more detail, but I am getting that experience. And I was curious about LLM, so I actually asked ChatGPT to take on the role of an expert speaking at a panel to a bunch of language teachers and responding to questions from the language teachers in clear and understandable ways. And so the first thing I did was ask it, so what is an LLM? Just like we asked you. And it gave a nice description, no math to speak of in it. And then I said, so how does it work? And then it talked about a lot of the things you did. It's nice to know you're confirmed with ChatGPT. And I followed that one. And one of the things it said was, well, I'm actually just telling you what the likely next word is. And that's how it's being constructed. And then I went back and asked it again. I won't go through the whole dialogue, but essentially I said, so how do you know how to start? And it gave me an answer. And what I learned from that is that by engaging in this kind of interaction, which does feel like you're interacting with an expert, I'm getting the sense that I'm learning in a much more me-directed way, because I'm doing all the questioning. And I think that's a valuable thing for teachers to try, if they haven't, to really engage these in conversations in areas where they know something, so they can check to make sure they're not being fooled. I guess we'll get into hallucinations and so on later on too. So that's just an aside, but I wanted to bring it up because it is there's a difference between knowing something about how LLMs work and beginning to understand it. And that understanding can only come through experience layered on top of the facts.
This is a good point, and it's a very good example. As ChatGPT told you, it only generates forms, right? Mm-hmm. It gives you the next, finally calls it a word, it's probably going to have some kind of shorthand. It gives you the next form that looks like a word, basically, because it deals with those tokens in some way and kind of generates those in different languages at enormous speed, at enormous levels of complexity, because it has literally thousands of these different layers in which it can process this. And I love that term. Apparently, it has multiple attention heads. I wish I had. So it can look at one piece of text at the different words up to kind of, I think the number was 126. 126 words at the same time and deal with them at the same time. Which sometimes, yes, then leads to its own problems. But most of the time, it goes right and it generates these forms. And since, as you were saying, in both examples, both with the French and the LLM, you had some prior knowledge. Yes, you were also a learner and you were taking the position of a learner in both of them. So let's start with the French as a kind of learner of French. But had... And you were doing, I am assuming, kind of intermediate level. I don't know what your French is like. Level French in some way, relatively everyday conversations, right, that you can have with your grandchildren or with some neighbors who you encounter when you visit your family in Switzerland.
Yeah, I'd say I'm trying to break through to A2.
A2, yeah.
I'm on the verge, I think.
So that, of course, is also a little more easy to generate in through the large language model. So it's less likely to go completely wrong in some way, because these are also very frequent items that get generated there in almost any language, I would think. And you have the, most importantly, I think, you have the ability to check. Maybe not for every minute detail there. You have to trust the machine, and its role is kind of teaching you something. But it won't let you lead you completely astray, basically. And that is, I was talking about teachers earlier and what the LLM means for the teachers. This idea, well, I'm actually dealing with a machine. For the learners, there is one additional one. Learners get information from the teachers, from a textbook, from the library, or whatever. Hopefully information they can trust if the teacher is well-trained and things like that. They don't have the same control over a machine, and we're often asking users of these chatbots, as you well know, Phil, the reminder often is, oh, check the answers, check the output of the chatbot or whatever. This is, for learners, this is very difficult. That's an additional challenge. Sometimes I believe we should not ask them to do that because we're supposed to teach them. That's exactly, they can't know. They're not supposed to know that. How can they check it? You teach them that and, you know, kind of move them along in some way. So, yeah, there are additional hurdles and things to consider. And that's why a number of people, and I'm sure we'll talk about the notion of intelligence and artificial intelligence in one of the kind of future conversations. It's a little bit misleading, this artificial intelligence, right? It's not intelligent enough to kind of teach you. You can't completely trust it. Also, learners need to be aware of, call it limitations in some way, but also of the strengths, what they can do. To make a kind of polemic point and move us along, basically, in this conversation, I mentioned a name, Emily Bender, already. She was the lead author of a paper where they, I believe, coined the phrase. I'm not 100% sure, but certainly used it and made it mainstream because Google fought it and things like that. The paper became almost notorious in some way. The phrase is stochastic parrots. And that's what they use to explain the LLM, basically the large language model. In a later book that has just come out this year by Emily Bender and Alex Hanna, I love that phrase. They talk about machines extruding synthetic text. Both of those, stochastic parrots, I'm going to say a few words about that in a second. I guess the other phrase is clear, extruding synthetic text. Both of them are very negative, and they're trying to make a point there. They're, Emily Bender is a computational linguist, so it's not like she is a Luddite or something like that. But she is very, very critical of these large language models for a whole raft of mainly ethical and socioeconomic reasons. That's my interpretation. I mean, one would have to ask her. And where she interests is with those stochastic parrots. Stochastic basically means you're doing things by chance. So it's a parrot who gets it right and sounds very eloquent just by chance. It's just serendipity. The old word stochastic was apparently used for kind of bow and arrows. Like you would literally, by accident, hit the target with your arrow. You had no idea what to do with bow and arrow. That was the stochastic kind of thing. And of course, there's statistic and mathematics in there and things like that. It's a little bit more. It's a very high probability. And the texts we get are very plausible. And Bender and Hanna do not deny that in any way. But it's this awareness. If we really be polemic about it, it's just hollow text, basically. It's hollow form that we're actually getting. It doesn't mean anything.
So you've touched on this a bit, but maybe you could explain in a little more detail what's human-to-human conversation, which is what all our second language acquisition theories are based on. How's that different from human to chatbot?
When the two of us are talking, if I'm being a good boy, I'm listening while you're talking and I'm not interrupting. Mm-hmm. While I'm listening, I'm doing a number of things. That's just the way cognition works, basically. Mm-hmm. Of course, the first thing is I'm kind of getting through the auditory channels. I'm literally listening in the narrow sense. I'm parsing the utterances, gave, so I'm kind of chunking them, putting them in, kind of realizing what this means and what the structure is and things like that. But I'm not reacting to the utterance per se. What I am reacting to is my reasoning about your intention. So you are saying something, and I'm thinking, why did he tell me that? What's his point? And then based on that reasoning, that's how I react. Because I want to, being nice, and this is those Gricean maxims of conversation, I want to be relevant. I want to be informative. I want to be cooperative. That's a kind of, I know they're all ideals, but that's really how it works most of the time. Does it break down then if somebody kind of doesn't reason right, doesn't understand something right or whatever? Yes. But as long as there's no malicious actor in the conversation, it it really does work most of the time. That's why we are so used to it. So now I'm doing exactly the same when I interact with the computer. The best way of explaining, let me use a human-human example first. Dinner situation, and somebody says, can you pass me the salt? It's a standard example from these kind of linguistic analyses. And my reasoning then is, oh, it's a yes-no question. It asks, there's can in the front, so it asks after my ability. But I know that this person who is asking me knows that, of course, I'm well able to pass the salt. I'm sitting close enough, I'm strong enough to even lift the kind of the salt shaker, and I can do that. So they would, this wouldn't be informative. They wouldn't ask me that. Because that would be patronizing. They're almost saying you're not capable of it or whatever. And no, it's dinner. They're not trying to offend me. I'm not being threatened. So there must be another reason. And then I realize, oh, they're sitting further away from the salt. All they want me to do is kind of move it closer to them so that they can use it on, I don't know, on their potatoes or something. So that's what I mean with reasoning about intention. We're kind of excluding things and whatever. Now we get these plausible texts from a chatbot, a Gen AI chatbot, and we're doing the same reasoning. And the fallacy is the problem we are having. The machine does not have an intention.
Right.
It did not, the machine did not produce the text because it wanted to say something, wanted to give me information or whatever. The machine generated that text because I triggered it. I clicked something. That's the only reason, the only occasion, the only trigger for the generation of the text. There is no other thing there. And so, yeah, that's the major difference, basically.
So there's, from a second language acquisition perspective, there's the simulation of negotiation of meaning, but it's all on your side as the human in terms of trying to extract meaning from the chatbot. And similarly, there's no co-construction of meaning because, again, all the meaning's on your side. The chatbot is presumably generating semantically relevant forms, but it doesn't have the sense of meaning behind it. Is that right?
Right. The best way I can explain this, yes, this is absolutely right. The best way I can explain this is with literature. So doesn't matter. A novel, a novella, a poem. Mm-hmm. You're reading something.
Mm-hmm.
The author, the poet, the novelist clearly had an intention and imbued that text with some meaning. That's why they wrote it. Mm-hmm. It might just have been purely aesthetic if that's what they wanted. It might have been very politically activist. It might have been philosophical. Might have just been entertaining, whatever. But they had something.
Mm-hmm.
Now you're picking it up and you're reasoning sometimes. Mm-hmm. Also, what intention did they have? The proverbial, what does the author want us to, want to say? Goes a little further than that, but kind of we're trying to kind of figure out, so kind of what does that mean? What does it mean to us? How can I make this, how can I participate in this shared experience?
Mm-hmm.
And the phrase always was, the reader completes the meaning of the literary text.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, with a GenAI chatbot,
mm-hmm.
there's nothing to complete because there's no meaning in there. So what the reader does is, and whether it's a teacher or a learner or anyone, whether it's a second language or first language, it really doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
The reader, the one who also often prompted, because it's usually one and the same person, right? The one who prompted and receives the output text imbues that output text with meaning. Literally, we make sense of it.
Mm-hmm.
The machine doesn't have any sense, basically. Mm-hmm. As in, there is no meaning in that text. And yes, it's a kind of big phrase, this negotiation of meaning. That's this reasoning about intentions, as we do. And second language learners learn to do that in the second language. And we think, oh, I didn't understand that. And do I need to go... If I need to go to the post office, do I need to turn right or did you say left? And we're kind of working this out in some way. None of that can happen with the machine. So we're literally parroting, mimicking it, basically.
Mm-hmm. So that means when I'm reading one of your papers, that I'm just putting all the meaning in myself because it's just digital marks on my screen.
No, because I generated them with meaning. I didn't generate them. That was the wrong word. I wrote them with meaning. I wrote them with intention.
I see. So you didn't
just
extrude.
So you will reason about what does this guy want me to know? What is he on about? And then you might come to a totally different conclusion than I did. Mm-hmm. And that's absolutely fine. Unless I generate, and that's why generating research papers with something like ChatGPT is so dangerous, right? And there have been proposals by very large companies to do exactly that. If this is generated by a machine, then of course it's not genuine research. Then yes, you would just have to put in all the meaning, which sometimes is nigh impossible because it's just, quite frankly, some very elegant gobbledygook, basically, in some way.
Okay, so what can we, or what advice do you have about using a chatbot then? What kind of conversations, knowing that it's really one-sided, but we have this, it's almost like another literary term I remember, a willing suspension of disbelief. So I feel like
that's
I'm engaging in a real conversation. So what are some ideas of using it for conversation practice then? What should we be paying attention to?
You know this much better than I do. Technology very often also is about access. We can do things with technology that are much, much more difficult to do with a bunch of humans, basically, because labor is expensive or location is difficult, schedules are difficult in some way. So when it comes to conversation, the huge advantage of the machine is you have the most patient conversation partner ever.
Mm-hmm.
If you wanted to repeat it again and again and again, mm-hmm. with listening or whatever, because you didn't fully understand it or you just want to practice some more, mm-hmm. you can. Mm-hmm. And the machine will not give up or mm-hmm. start shouting at you or walking away or something like mm-hmm. that. It's available 24/7. That's almost a cliche, but it's true.
Yeah.
And it this also, and maybe I should have forefronted this, use it as a conversation partner.
Mm-hmm.
As a language learner, perhaps also as a teacher, use it for brainstorming. Use it to ask in a dialogue mm-hmm. what an LLM is. Ask clarification mm-hmm. questions and kind of work your way around and things. And use it in this artificial conversation to mm-hmm. kind of for your purposes. Mm-hmm. For language learning, I think it's very important. Again, an advantage because it's so good at generating these forms.
Right.
And they're so accurate. Use the opportunity, particularly as a language learner, but I'm sure mm-hmm. it's relevant for some language teachers too. Mm-hmm. Pay attention to the beautiful accuracy.
Mm-hmm.
Pick up new words. Pick up the grammatical constructions used in there. Pay attention to the use of prepositions, mm-hmm. Subject-verb agreement on whatever the grammatical features are, because if you notice it, another concept from second language acquisition, you are going to learn. And mm-hmm. yes, you can notice things in that
mm-hmm.
machine output. Most importantly, as a kind of conclusion for this conversation, I think,
mm-hmm.
It's a question of awareness. Awareness is very important in learning. Do your best, because it is difficult, and I'm speaking from personal experience.
Mm-hmm.
Do your best to always be aware that it is a machine you're interacting with.
Mm-hmm.
As in, as the Brits would say, take it with a pinch of salt.
Yes.
Be a little careful with what you do, what you put in, what you ask it to do. There are clear limitations. Don't trust everything you see on the screen and the output. Work with it.
Mm-hmm.
Work with the strengths of the machine, and they're clearly in those two areas, like patience and accuracy. Work with those, use those to your advantage, and make sure, no, it's a machine. It sometimes does things which, no, they won't happen in real life, basically.
All right. Well, for this episode, for this conversation, a lot of what you've been talking about is covered in the first part of our paper. There are some things you have certainly added and gone into much more detail on, but I think in future conversations we'll be deconstructing that paper a bit more and hopefully following through on what, you know, our goal is, I think, which is to try to share our own journey through understanding this new technology and making it work for us instead of making us work for it.
Right. And just one additional note on the actual paper. This is a journal article, and that journal article is open access. When we get a chance to put this recording out there,
mm-hmm.
the link to the actual article will be right next to that recording. So people can also, yes, you can have the pleasure of listening to us for half an hour or so, but you can also double check everything that we are saying here in this particular article. And of course, there are many, many others. There's a whole proliferation now of articles, book chapters, whole books on generative artificial intelligence and language learning, language teaching in particular, but also beyond, of course.
All right.
All right. I think we can
sounds good. Well, see you next time, Matt.
See you next time. More topics to discover. Opening AI for language learning.
We are grateful for the support for Opening AI for Language Learning by the Language and Applied Research Center at San Diego State University and the Southern Area International Languages Network, CALIN, which is part of the California World Languages Project. Our producer and editor is Chris Brown. Mario Condo-Fenol is the production coordinator of WHILE. Live conversations are moderated and promoted by me, Shanaz Ahmadian. And remember, artificial intelligence is no substitute for natural ignorance. Until next time.